Somehow I think the electric bill alone would be a bigger budget.
Okay, very good. They call them star chips. That's what he's going to be sending out to Alpha Centauri. Wow. You know, I mean, I don't even understand. Once they get there, what are they going to all, like, team up together and create a big enough transmitter to transmit a signal back to Earth that, hey, we're here? I don't get it. But it's he's not fooling around. He's poured a lot of money into it. Back to you.
Like I said before, the world needs dreamers, and if you didn't have people dreaming, we wouldn't have gotten anywhere. I mean, people have been writing about landing on the moon for more than 100 years before we did it, although at the very beginning, they used propulsion bullets. You remember the film where they shot a bullet into the man on the moon, and he kind of grimaces when the bullet hits one of his... Wesley recognized.
Hey, what is the biggest power achievable for the peak? For the peak power? If we were to send the signal, either by means of radio wave or laser signal, if we were to build or use the energy, how much of energy we could store in the impulse per unit of time. Right.
Well, natural astronomical objects have shown us that there's no low limitation for that. Neutron stars, you got pulsars, you got enormous gamma ray bursts, so the fabric of space-time can take a heck of a lot of energy being thrust through it before it breaks down. So I think we talked about Schwinger's limits and non-linearity of very, very high-frequency gamma rays, but you can throw a lot of energy. The problem is whether mankind can engineer anything close to that amount of energy. But naturally occurring objects, incredible amounts of energy out in the electromagnetic spectrum.
Well, we would ask 200 years ago if the man could create television. I don't believe it's a problem that you could anticipate as non-doable. Dr. Ray.
Okay, on a theoretical basis, I can't disprove that we won't be able to do something as long as it doesn't violate the laws of physics. But you've done this many times. You can't simply use an example where science was wrong to thereby prove that everything that science ever said is going to be wrong. Science is usually right more than it's wrong. Tends to be somewhat more consistent than just random choices that people make while sitting on rocks and thinking about it. I got a particular presentation one of these days I'm going to do about Aristotle and all the incredibly stupid things that he suggested about the universe. So it's not really legitimate to say, well, they didn't know about television 200 years ago, so anti-gravity beams and death rays and such can happen next week. I mean, can they? Yeah, but are they likely to? Probably, very probably not.
I believe you put that into incorrect brackets. We're not to give a science being wrong. We're talking about progress of the science not being predicted. The Moore's law wasn't known 200 years ago. Interesting.
Again, you cannot disprove that something theoretically possible not happen. You can give it a probability for all that's worth, and you know, live one day at a time And I hope I'm terribly wrong about all the discoveries, and that tomorrow people discover all kinds of great things that I had no idea. And if you ever go back to the old popular mechanics and popular science about the future, you'll see that they got a lot of things wrong. There was a lot of flying cars and no computers and such. And so, you know, we just don't know what the future will bring, and I will give you that. But that doesn't necessarily prove that in 100 years we're going to be able to use the power that a pulsar has.
I completely agree with you. You're actually right. Enter exit.
Okay, very well. I think we've done this topic, and I really would like to hear the space report. So, Let's call it an end for this episode, and until next week, and please send me your thoughts and comments and suggestions and topics and such, and I'll see what I can do with it.
Thank you very much, Roy. Good stuff. And now, I think it's time for Paul to tell us what is NASA doing and all those other great guys doing. And as I mentioned in the email you and I had today, NASA is now by way of the Goddard Space Flight Center. They are working on a robotic object that will be able to go out there and do servicing and repairs and whatever of the satellites that are in space. They're finally starting to build that piece of hardware. Goddard is looking forward to that. WS2N, K2RIW, and Paul, time for space report number 294. You've got it, Paul.
Okay, very good. This is WS2N, and I think you're talking about Restore L, the satellite program. And there's other ones out there. So we'll talk about that in a minute or two. Just the other day, Thursday, company Virgin Galactic, that's Richard Branson, he owns that, and he's been trying to put passengers into space for quite a few years now. He's the guy that had they call it Spaceship One that crashed, I guess that was 14 years ago. And now he's built another one called, again, Spaceship 2. The first one he had a name, he called it Enterprise, he's calling this one Unity. And he's coming a long way. And last year he has taken this new spaceship and flown it half a dozen times in test flights. He drops it from, they call it the White Knight, to a vehicle. It's jet power there. Flying, carrying a vehicle, and he drops it, and on the test run, it comes down and lands on the runway. He's checked this out, checked that out. Well, Thursday, he was able to test it and light off the engine for the first time. It's a relatively big vehicle. He's got two pilots on board. Eventually, he plans on having people pay money to sit in the back of the spacecraft and fly into space, not orbital, suborbital, but still space, anything above the common line. Plans on getting up to over 62 miles. Well, this time he tested it. He dropped the Unity from the White Knight at around 45,000 feet, roughly, high up where a jet would normally fly. And then it dropped, and then he lit off the engine for 30 seconds, pointed the spacecraft, they said around 80 degrees, and it took off, and he got up to around a little over 80,000 feet. So it's a long way, almost 17 miles, but he eventually would like to get up to over 60 miles. So that'll come in the future. They'll have longer and longer burns, but this burn lasted for 30 seconds, and apparently he was very successful. On the way down, the whole back of it split. You know, it's got like two wings coming out of the back of this spacecraft. And the whole spacecraft really splits in half, and the wings slow its descent down into the atmosphere. He's pretty high up, so it's, the atmosphere is not bothering it at 80,000 feet. And it creates like a shuttlecock if you're playing a badminton, that effect. And that's what slows the vehicle down as it comes through the atmosphere. And then when it gets a little bit lower, he transitions it back to normal, and he came down and lands on a regular runway down in Mojave Desert. So we'll see how he does. He plans on doing a couple more flights, and he thinks by early 2019 he might be able to have paying passengers go on these suborbital flights. You know, put six people in there with two pilots that run roughly around $200,000 a piece, and be able to fly this thing over and over again. Gets up to around, well, this flight he got up to 1.8 Mach, so it's almost two times the speed of sound, but plans are going a lot faster eventually to get up to that 62 mile plus altitude. So we'll see how he makes out. We always follow Branson. He's quite a character. He's also developed a rocket that will probably fly at the end of this year. That he's going to be dropping from a 747. And he's actually changed the name of this particular company. It's a spinoff of Virgin Galactic. It's called Virgin Orbit. They took the 747, and then that became a carrier plane for these rockets that he's going to launch. Now, these will go into orbit, and he'll plans on launching 300, maybe 500-pound satellites into orbit using this airplane. And this combination of airplane rocket. The program's called Mantra 1. That's been in development for about 5 or 6 years. And he's about ready to test that. Many missions to talk about. I can't cover all of them. Just to give you an idea, going up to the International Space Station this year. Now, we're already in April, but there's 12 more missions just going to the International Space Station from three different countries. You have Russia, of course, sending different crews up to the space station. They also have two cargo missions planned for the Progress vehicle to resupply the space station. SpaceX has, I think, three missions going up to the space station. One of them is going to be a crewed vehicle, but without a crew. And it should be around August. Looks like the end of August. It's going to be the actual crewed vehicle that will eventually have a crew. But before they do anything, they want to test this autonomously, send it up to the space station, let it stay there for a week or two. And then undock, and I mean dock, because it'll be going to a different port on the space station. Right now, they wrap up all the cargo vehicles with this Canadian robot arm. When it gets close, they grab it, and then they bring it up and they attach it to different berthing ports on the space station, and it takes some time. It has 16 bolts that have to electronically drive the two vehicles together, the space station and the Dragon. But the crewed vehicle is going to be different. It's going to be docking autonomously with no crew, and it's going to be going to a different port. They have these pressure mating adapters, one and pressure, no, pressure rating adapter number 2 and pressure rating adapter number 3. Two different ports to choose from. So stay there a couple of weeks, like I said, and then disconnect and come back and parachute down into the Atlantic Ocean. And then if that's a success, they expect to have a crew do the same thing. And that's a, you know, some vehicle that's built for these crewed Dragon vehicles early next year. And they're not the only ones following them, not far behind. Around the same time that Dragon will be sending up an unmanned vehicle to dock at the space station, about a month later, Boeing will be doing the same thing with their Starliner. That's the name of their vehicle, the Starliner, which will eventually will be able to carry a crew of 4 as well. But they'll be sending it up unmanned, dock to the space station, and then they'll come back and not land in the water. They're going to land on land. So, parachute down and probably come down and I believe they think they're going to be landing in the Utah desert. Drop it. So that's a bit of a different design. They have these big airbags that are going to inflate right before they land. So that's the story on future launches to the space station. The next important launch I plan on watching, it will be on the 16th. So not this Monday, not tomorrow, but the following Monday. You have the test mission going up, and that's this transiting exoplanet survey satellite. We've talked about that many times. That's going to be the one that's pretty much replacing the Kepler Space Telescope. Kepler is the one that has discovered all of these planets, thousands of planets in its history. And they're going to be sending up the test, a completely different design, completely different orbit. And that will be launched from a Falcon 9. You know, SpaceX has a contract with NASA to launch that thing. And we're looking forward to getting that thing into space. Because of that unusual orbit, it's going to be going in orbit around Earth, but to do that, they'll be going out to the distance of the moon and then coming back to around 6,000 miles above the Earth, not very close to the Earth, and then back out again to the lunar orbit every 14 days, actually 13.7 days. They'll be making one trip around the Earth. So that should be pretty interesting to do that. You know, they plan on avoiding the Van Allen belt, number one, and also having a strange orbit, not in the ecliptic plane of the Earth or the planets, but, 90 degrees perpendicular to it. By doing that, they'll avoid having any kind of eclipse, an eclipse problem with Earth. As it's taking all its measurements with four cameras looking out, CCD cameras, all aimed pretty much in the same direction, covering a wide swath of the sky. Eventually, over a 2-year period of time, that originally it's going to be a 2-year mission, over that 2-year period, they plan on covering maybe 90% of the sky, where Kepler was pretty much aimed at one small location for the first couple of years of its service. This is WS1. We get down to lower power here. Okay. One other mission I'm looking forward to, it doesn't sound like it's very exciting because it's a launch for Bangladesh, putting a satellite into geosynchronous orbit, again by SpaceX. It's going to be launching on a Falcon 9. And that will be at, you know, a couple of weeks from now, actually, at the end of April, April 24th. And the reason I'm interested in it is because it's a new rocket. It doesn't look much different than the original boosters, you know, the Falcon 9 rocket, but it's built completely different. It's got a heat shield right above the engine compartment. It's got some kind of a protective coating on the rocket itself. And the idea of it, of this new rocket, they call it Block 5, is to have it reusable, not just once like the previous boosters of SpaceX. You know, they landed many boosters safely and then reused them, but they only reused them once. This one, they plan on reusing up to 10 different times. And then rework the booster and then bring it back and do it again up to 100 cycles. So I'd like to see how good that one goes, because that is the booster that they will be using to send people up, our astronauts, from Earth, from American soil. My guess is that's going to be the first one to go into orbit from American soil. I think they're going to be Boeing, but I don't know. You never know what happens. Boeing might, you know, take the lead and do the same thing. Boeing's Starliner spacecraft that they're building is going to be launched on an Atlas V rocket. Atlas V rocket, very successful rocket. They just don't have any failures there. Like 100% successful, and they plan on putting the Starliner on top of that, and that'll have two small solid boosters attached to it, and it'll have a different upper stage than what it runs now. It just runs one RL-10 liquid oxygen rocket on the second stage. The new ones for the manned flights will have two rockets for the second stage. So that should be very interesting for, you know, for the end of this year and early next year when the manned flights start going up and dropping. Okay, this is WS2N. A couple of other flights. I follow the Electron rocket a lot. That's the one by Peter Beck. He's a billionaire that started this program. They call the Electron rockets, and not that it has anything to do with Electron, but he's got these batteries, these lithium polymer batteries that drive these turbopumps. Usually they have like the exhaust on a rocket driving turbopumps to create the pressure to pump all this fuel into the rocket chambers. This guy is using electric motors and is using battery power. And he's got nine engines on each first stage. And he has one engine for a second stage. And that's strong enough to put, say, 500 pounds into Earth orbit. They've launched two of these so far. One didn't make it to orbit. Not that there was anything wrong with the rocket, but they had a communication failure with the ground, and they decided to destroy the rocket. But the second one went up, and that was successful. Put a couple of satellites into orbit, and now he's actually going into commercial operations. His goal is to be launching one of these things at least once a month. So this will be his first commercial rocket to be launched. And, you know, he's really an American company. He's got everything set up in California, but he wanted to find his own launch complex and build his own line. Orange Complex, which he did. He built it on the North Island of New Zealand, and that's where he launches these Electron rockets from. So, you're following his career. There's plenty of small rockets to be launched, and I think he's at the, everybody's trying to do the same thing. I mentioned Virgin Orbital was trying to do the same thing. There's a couple of other ones. Strata Launcher organization by Paul Allen. But they're all in development. They're getting close. But this guy's actually done it. He's already done it. And this is his first commercial launch. He's launching, I think, two or three satellites. That's pretty much it. There is one other launch we've been following. I know we seem to be talking about the Parker Solar Probe, and that should be the end of July, July 31st. And that's the one that's going to go to the moon, into the corona of the sun. Into the sun, into the corona of the sun. So that's the Parker Solar Probe. That's pretty much it. Anybody have any questions, comments for the space portion of the TechNet? This is WS2N. Back to you, Dick.
Anybody have any questions for Paul? If so, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW. Both AC2LR and AC2IS. AC2LR first, go ahead.
I would love to hear more about the Corona study, if you have any information on that.
You got a call.
Yeah, okay, that's the Parker Solar Probe. And that'll be launched, like I said, at the end of July. And it should take about 7 years to get to its location. Now, it's a relatively small satellite, spacecraft, a couple thousand pounds. But yet they're launching it on the Delta IV Heavy. Delta IV is, the biggest rocket that NASA launches. And, even by itself, and when you have the Delta IV Heavy, that's three Delta IV boosters bolted together. So it's a massive booster. This is the same setup that launched the Orion spacecraft, unmanned, of course. They wanted to test out the heat shield and the avionics. And back in 2014, they did just that, but they needed the biggest rocket that we have. So here's a small spacecraft. What are they putting it on the Delta Heavy for? By the way, they're going to launch it from Launch Complex 37B, and from Florida. And they need this big, massive rocket to actually. They've got to take the momentum out of us going around the sun. Right now we're moving at 66,000 miles per hour going around the sun. That speed has to change so that this solar probe can get in toward the sun. If you stay at that speed, it would never be able to, it would just stay in orbit around the sun, so they've got to deaccelerate. And it's not even strong enough with this big rocket to do that with the drop it. It's going to take seven years, so it's seven times they're going to pass Venus, and I think one or two times past Mercury, to use the gravitational effect to actually slow the spacecraft down to take that forward momentum out of it so it can start getting pulled toward the sun. And when it goes past the sun, it's going to be going like minimum 150,000 miles an hour, probably much even faster than that. I haven't found the speed yet. So that's the story in that case. By the way, I heard you talk about the ISS sighting. I don't know if you saw it. You got me interested again, and I wound up looking up the next pass. There is one tomorrow, but not that good. But there's another one on Wednesday. It looks pretty good as well. not directly overhead like the one tonight. Back to you, AC2LR, WS.
Thanks, Paul. This is AC2LR. I was wondering why it's studying, what are we looking for in the corona? And also, I'm assuming it's going to be really close to the sun. Does it have heat shields of some sort to keep it, keep the instrument from frying? and by the way, I did see the ISS. Where I live, I first saw it around 8:47, and it was bright. I thought it was a plane. It looked like two headlights coming along. And it went right across the center of the box of the Big Dipper and continued bright as anything. To me, it looked like a plane almost. Only it was silent and just moving a lot more, further away, so it was slower. And then it disappeared around Zanabola, which is the tail of Leo. All of a sudden, it just vanished. So it was really cool. Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, that sounds good. I saw it was -9 magnitude, so that was probably good. And two nights from now, it's supposed to be brighter. It's going to be -2 point something. But not as high in elevation, so I don't know if the trees are going to get in the way. So tonight was really a good night. So with that. Yeah, the Parker solar probe is going to have on the front of it, protecting it from the heat. Carbon, that black material that they use on the nose of all the space shuttles that were built. That was, they call it carbon. Well, they made this 4 inches thick, and that's going to, be in the leading edge of the Parker solar probe. Behind that, they'll have the electronics and all the equipment. And then they'll have... They do have solar panels. Now, solar panels will be normal. They'll be normally operating when it's not near the sun. But when it starts to get in close like that, they're going to have active fluid going through the solar panels. And it's radiated behind it. So there's some kind of a pump, pumping fluids to keep the solar panels from burning up. And as far as how close they're going to get under... 4 million miles, so it'll be 3.8 million miles from the surface of the sun, so actually within the corona we drop it. So that's close. We've had other satellites. There were two others called the Helios project. That had been 30 years ago. And, it came nowhere near as close to where the sun is, as this particular one is going to do it. So that's the best we've done so far. And I forget how far that was. So that's the story. And what they're going to study, I guess they want to know a lot about the corona. And they want to know, why is the corona hotter than the surface of the sun? It's like 1,000,000 degrees in the corona, right? 10,000 degrees down on the surface. I've heard different stories, in particular from Carl Sagan from traffic. And back then, he had one of his books that, could be sound. There is sound on the surface of the sun that creates all this movement on the surface of the sun. Water, and the sound could be traveling up with, away from the sun when you big mass ejections, and maybe this is hitting the atmosphere, the corona, and this is impacting, and could be heating the corona. I've heard that story, a couple of other stories. So they really want to pin it down. Why is the corona so hot? That's what I know about it. I know there's other scientific investigations going on, but I'm more interested in the spacecraft itself and how it's going to survive and everything. Back to you.
Thank you. I know AC2IS is waiting, but before I may not get a chance to talk again. I just want to quickly tell you, last week I saw Timothy Blatch from Stony Brook University talk at a library about the OSIRIS-REx mission, which is going to be reaching the asteroid Bennu in August. And he's one of the two spectroscopic astronomers who's going to, they've been already studying, you know, a whole bunch of things about the asteroid. It sounds so interesting. The asteroid itself was chosen, I mean, for ease of, you know, approach that they can actually get to it. But it's also, they're thinking, you know, one of the oldest things in the solar system, and they're going to actually collect samples, fly back to Earth, and be able to study them. So that was really cool. And then something else, this Wednesday, ASLI is having their, you know, speaker come. He's going to be talking about the Mars mission, and I thought they would be interested in this. This Wednesday night, 8 p.m. at the Vanderbilt Planetarium. I just let it drop for a second. And the gentleman who's speaking is going to be talking about all the difficulties we will face physiologically, psychologically, and technically getting there. And Dick, I know you always keep, you know, saying that it's going to take a long time and it's going to be a lot harder than we think. And I think this guy is agreeing with you. So I just thought you might be interested in that talk, 8 p.m. this coming Wednesday, April 11th at the Vanderbilt Planetarium. Okay, back to you, Paul. This is AC2LR.
And then be able to take the arm and put it inside this lander, which will eventually, it's going to be encapsulated into it, and then this lander, years from now, I think it's 3, 4, 5 years from now, eventually, it'll get back to Earth, and again, I think that's going to land in the Utah desert. I believe before it lands, they're going to have a helicopter grab it from the sky, we have the parachute or something. We'll see how that works out. I think that's going to be a great mission. It's been done twice before. Sample returns going to Utah. One was a Genesis mission, and that thing crashed into the surface, but they were able to save some stuff from it. That was the type of thing. Similar type of thing. It went out to an asteroid or, I don't know, brought something back from somewhere. And it crashed into the surface. But the one that was more successful was Stardust, and that went out to Built 2, a comet, and that had this aerogel, looked like a tennis racket filled with aerogel that slept in. It was very light, but it was able to catch any dust or particles coming off the tail of the comet. And that successfully put it into the lander, encapsulated it into the lander. That was the winner. They brought that back to Utah as well. And so I think Bennu will probably be successful. Sounds complicated, but, you know, they've had some experience with this type of thing before. Now, you said another station had a comment. Was there another station that was going to say something? Was it Bill? I don't know. This is WS2.
Yes, it's Bill. And I've got some further information for Bill. But go ahead, Bill, with your question or comment.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. I was just wondering about SpaceX. Semi-recently, they had a launch with 3 boosters, and I believe all 3 boosters landed so that they could be reused. 2 of them landed, I think, on an island, and they landed at the same time. The third, I'm not sure where it landed, possibly on a barge, like some previous booster landings. I think maybe there was not video of that recorded for some reason. But I guess my question is, How many people saw that? I did not see that live, but how many people saw the double booster landing, the tandem booster landing? And I'm not sure this is a question that can be answered or even has an answer, but why do you think it is that the landing of the two boosters especially simultaneously, why do you think that looks so unreal? It looks almost like you're watching a simulation, sort of too precise. So there's the question, AT2IF.
Okay, Bill, yeah, these things come flying out of the sky in Florida, and the people that were watching it, they knew it was real. Yeah, that was a... You know, the news media really pushed that. That was great. He put a call on for a payload. He's going to send it off to heliocentric orbit. So it's going to go around. It's going around the sun as we speak. So he took the three boosters and three Falcon 9 boosters, and on top of the middle one, he's got the second stage that he normally does, which is just one Merlin engine. And so therefore, at the bottom, he had 27 Merlin engines that had to light off exactly at the same time. Actually, it's about a couple of milliseconds of difference between each rocket. They do that because one didn't light, the computers on board, the rocket would shut everything down, and it would abort, and it would just sit there, and they would figure out what was wrong. But it went fine. It took off. It got out over the ocean. The two boosters separated successfully. They used pyrotechnics to separate. They used nitrogen jets, which separate the two boosters, one on starboard, one on port. And then it turns around. It's actually in space. It's got. They don't have to worry about the atmosphere. Does a 180, we're dropping. They both relight three of their engines. So each booster now lights three Merlin engines instead of nine to start slowing itself down and actually boosting it. They call it a boost back burn. It brings it back to Cape Canaveral. And then, again, it turns around 90 degrees, starts coming through the atmosphere, and the engines bite again, the same three engines bite again, and that's the descent burn. And then right before they land, on land, and by the way, where they're landing, it's old Launch Complex 13, SpaceX took it over and they rebuilt it. Now they call it Landing Zone 1. Let me drop it. Now they've landed six boosters here already. So, you know, if you followed it, you would have seen other boosters coming back all by themselves. This one came back with two. And so he's got two landing facilities only about a couple miles away from where they took off. They took off from Launch Complex 39A. That's the famous launch complex that a lot of the shuttles took off from, and Saturn rockets when they went to the moon. SpaceX has taken over Launch Complex 39A. So a couple of miles from there, it's Landing Zone 1. They can fly out of the sky. The legs open up. There's about a 60-foot breadth with these four legs. Come down and land, and that was successful. And they did try to save the third booster. The plan was to go out in the autonomous ship out at sea, 400 miles out. Let me drop it. And land on the autonomous ship. This is a ship that's about the size of a football field. So they've done that many times before, too. This one... they wound up running, you know, like I said before, they have to reignite these engines as it's coming through the atmosphere. How they reignite them, they don't have a spark gap down there or anything. They reignite it with, the main fuel on board is kerosene.
kerosene and liquid oxygen. It's actually densified liquid oxygen. And to get that to ignite, they have to have another fuel, and it's called TTEP, T, and then TEP, two different chemicals. And when they touch each other, the ignition takes place, and that lights off the liquid kerosene and liquid densified oxygen. So they ran out of TTEP as it was coming down. And I did see a video, SpaceX did put it out, let me drop it, of this thing coming down, tail first, crashing into the ocean. Only a couple hundred yards off the barge, very close to the barge. So that's the story. Now they do have another launch like this coming up. I think that's about 4 months from now. They're launching a military satellite for United States, and they'll be doing the same thing. It's going to be launched with three boosters. They'll probably do the same thing, I would imagine, bring back the same two boosters, land them on at landing zone one, and probably land the third one on the autonomous ship this time, hopefully. That's the story, Bill. Any other questions? WS2N.
That's it. I had not heard about the third booster crashing, so thanks for that info. And thanks for all your other answers. BC2AS.
Yeah, I had some further information for you, Bill, and that is the Voyager, if we use that as an example of long distance and communication, I've already told you that it's out there more than 120 astronomical units. It took 40-some-odd years, a little more than 40 years to get there. It's now moving at something like 35,000 miles an hour. Paul will correct me on the exact speed. And we didn't have anywhere near enough boosting power to launch something that far, that fast, back in 1977 when that was launched. It got that beautiful speed. Let me drop it. Got that beautiful speed and distance because once in a lifetime, you have this very desirable alignment of a whole bunch of planets. So Voyager did a flyby, a gravity boost, by going by Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune in that order. So they got four boosts, and that allowed them to get that far that fast. So here it is, 120 astronomical units out there, three times the distance of Pluto, 35,000 miles an hour. If that was heading for Alpha Centauri, first of all, it is, that distance, Alpha Centauri is 4.5 light years. The distance to Voyager is right now is 0.19 astronomical units. To be one astronomical unit, you'd have to go 530 times further. And to do that one astronomical unit, one light year, would take, at the current rate, would take something like 20,000 years. So you can see that launching a spacecraft to get to Alpha Centauri, our nearest neighbor star, is a big deal. Let me drop this. And communicating multiple light years because of the way inverse square law works and the time delay. I mean, if you want to talk to somebody 10 light years away, and you say hello, in theory, you get an answer in 20 years. If he responds immediately, if he knew exactly where to aim, he was listening at exactly the time that you transmitted, he understood your message and so on. So you can see that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is very difficult. If the society we're looking at is putting out a tremendous amount of power, and it happens to be aimed in our direction, yes, we'll be able to detect them. But to listen to that weak carrier in the noise and say, hey, that's their broadcast station, sounds good on paper. Boy, it's difficult. AC2IS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I was only worried about talking to other things out there. I have not gotten anywhere near actually traveling. It seems like the light here. But yeah, it sounds like, you know, if we're going to be able to communicate with intelligent life, we better be darn close. Yeah, that's about as far as that thought process went. Thanks for all that inspiration. AC2IS.
One of the questions I got for you, Paul, maybe maybe Roy wants to address this one. Our particular sun is going to have a total life of in the vicinity of 10 billion years. And we're close to 5 billion years into that life. We're in the middle of it. It's a relatively stable star. Occasionally it hiccups, creates a coronal mass ejection aimed in our direction, which creates a great grief, like that event in 1859 where a huge amount of charged particles hit the Earth, and it created tremendous voltages across the telegraph lines. And if that event happened today, it would create a lot of damage of our satellites. Let me drop it. Now, the stars that last longer than ours are red dwarfs. The good news about a red dwarf is it can last a very long period of time. Therefore, a red dwarf society, a planet around a red dwarf, could have had a head start on us, let me pick a number, a billion years. And so they would be going around a red dwarf. The illumination of their planet would be a lot redder light, a lot dimmer light than we've got. That would explain why they would have large, dark-looking eyes, and it gives you a little bit of a feeling for some of the ETs that have been reported. Is that why they look the way they do? Because their planet was going around a red dwarf. So if red dwarfs are stable enough, live long enough, but still you're in the habitable zone, your planet, let me drop that. But you're far enough out that your planet is not tidal locked. It doesn't have one face always aiming toward the planet. From what you heard, I'm going to ask Paul first and then Roy in that order. Are we thinking that life originating around a red dwarf is very unlikely or quite possible? From what you've read, Paul, what do you think? And then I'll be asking Roy the same question. WS2N, K2RIW.
I heard one scientist talk about it not too long ago on Science Friday. And he was being interviewed by Ira Flato. And he believed that it was quite possible. Because even so, the red dwarfs are cooler. They've been around longer. More of a chance for some life to develop, and you have a situation where you're much closer to the sun, so you're going to be orbiting very quickly. So they think it's possible. By the way, you talked about Voyager before. It's coming up to almost 40 hours round trip, so. A little over 19 and a half hours one way for a signal. So, we used to talk about 35 hours or something. We're already up to almost 40 hours round trip. Back to this.
And what's the total number of astronomical units right now, Paul, and the approximate velocity right now, if you happen to remember these?
Yes, well, you got the 141 AU for Voyage 1 and 117 AU for Voyage 2. Voyage 1's going fast, I think it's around 38,000 miles per hour. And the other one is probably around 34, I can check. But it's going a little slower. Back to you.
That's really moving along. Roy, you got a feeling for life around a red dwarf? because they could have had a head start. See, we've got a third generation star. But maybe a second generation red dwarf will have enough of the right materials, and because it's so stable for such a long period of time, you have a feeling for whether or not the extraterrestrial life could form there. AC2GS, K2RIW, good, Roy.
AC2GS, well, it certainly has time on its side. That's the major benefit for a red dwarf. The problem is, and you kind of played with the tidal forces, it's way easier for a red dwarf to experience tidal force problems and heat variations and such. And so it's a very, it might be very stable as far as the star goes, but I'm not quite sure if the planetary system would be that stable. So I think it kind of splits down the difference with the amount of increased time probability. You might have some life on red dwarf systems, but I would still go looking first at something close to a G2 star.
And maybe we're going a little bit too far all the way to red dwarf. What would we call a star that's halfway between a red dwarf and RG2? Go ahead.
Gosh, there's a whole bunch of designations for stars. The smallest ones, I think, are O, and then it goes up, and it's not in alphabetical order, unfortunately, and there's a mnemonic that I totally forgot. But, you know, I mean, they're a G1. Ours is a G2, there's G1s, and there's, I think, a couple of initials for slightly cooler stars along the spectrum.
The mnemonic, the mnemonic for the stars, O-B-A-F-G and so on, O-B-A fine girl kiss me is the mnemonic. So the first letter of each of those words is the sequence of stars. It's the letters that they give to them. Do you recognize that mnemonic now, Roy?
Yes, I remember it. It didn't really stick in my mind, but, you know, I mean, like, I'll always remember Sakatoa, which doesn't mean anything except in trigonometry. But for some odd reason, that mnemonic didn't really stick. I recognize it when I hear it, but when I don't hear it for a while, I forget it.
Okay. You've just heard TechNet number 1694. Space report number 294, science and physics report with a whole lot of things about the stars. Science and physics number 24. We intend to be back next week, and I didn't get a chance to get into my puzzle on the subject of why is the bottom of a bicycle pump hot. We may get to that next week. The answer will surprise you. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. Bye bye for now. K2IW clear, and these guys have already told you that they finished their report. Thank you, fellas. Good stuff. K2IW listening.
WHYY with a question for you. I'd like to be put on the list next week. I ran out of a lot of time this week. I could not transmit after 9 o'clock.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. In other words, we had to get to you before 9. Is that what you're saying, Joe?
Yes, and I cannot transmit on the radio past 9 o'clock. Otherwise, I screw up when I'm recording off the air from TV. That's why I can't transmit. It blanks out my antenna amplifier.
Okay, you have to be off at 9. When are you allowed to come back on? At midnight?
11 o'clock.
Okay, so you've got a dead zone between 9 and 11. Now I understand. Want to give us a hint as to what your subject matter would have been?
Two different questions. You can take your pick. One would be on antennas, one would be on radar. And if you have time, I'll tell you a story about DFing a pirate radio station. Very interesting.
Okay, looking forward to hearing from you next week, Joe. So we're about to be cut off. Bye-bye for now, you guys.
W-H-Y-Y, clear. The time.
time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater.